My name is Jill Wolf. I'm 36 years old. Today is March 24th, 2016, and I'm at the Chicago Cultural Center with my friend and fellow advocate, Alicia.
Hi, I'm Alicia Suarez. I am 40. Today's date is March 24th, 2016. I'm at the Chicago Cultural Center, and I'm here with my friend, Jill.
Hey, Alicia.
Hi.
So as your friend, you know, I know you to be a passionate advocate and scholar. I'm sorry, I should have said Dr. Suarez when I started this off. So a doctor at that, who really has taken the personal and made it professional, and of course has many other professional endeavors. And I'm really hoping to learn a bit about how you got to that.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting here with me now.
Yeah. Well, I think I should start at the beginning, which in 1995, and I just looked back at a journal I had from then, and it was July 10th. So I should back up a second. I had been feeling really, really tired.
How old were you?
I was 19.
Not a good math. 19.
Yeah. So I was 19, and I had been feeling really tired for, I don't know, a couple of days, maybe a week. I don't really remember. And I thought, oh, I must have mono, right? Because that's what makes people tired. And my dad's a pathologist. And so on July 10th, 1995, I went to the hospital because he worked in the lab. He's a pathologist. And said, oh, I think I have mono. You need to do a blood draw and see if I have mono. So we did a blood draw, no big deal. And I went home. And then he called me, I don't know, within a couple hours, and said, your liver enzymes are sky high. You need to get your ass back here. And so I was super freaked out. So I called a friend of mine, took her with me, went back to the hospital, did more blood work, was sent to see a liver specialist.
This is on the same day?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, that's because my dad's a doctor,
yeah,
right? And
high,
so
know people in the high places, right?
Yeah, totally, right? So he just like squeezed, you know, walked me over to see Dr. Cassidy and was like, this is my daughter. Talk to her. Figure out, you know. And I could tell there was enough fear. I mean, I could sense that this was serious, right? So I knew that something serious was going on. And I talked to Dr. Cassidy and I was honest with him. And they didn't give me a diagnosis that day, I don't think. I think it was a couple of days later. So that's kind of the beginning of all this, you know. I mean, that was, of course, the diagnostic experience is really powerful. And
they gave you a diagnosis?
Right.
Of?
Hepatitis C. And, of course, I had no idea what that meant. In 1995, no one knew what that meant, really. I mean, it had just been called hepatitis C, as you know, before it was, you know, non-A, non-B.
6 years by that point, it had been known as hep C.
Right, right. So certainly a lack of public discourse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, no one knew what hepatitis C was. I'd never heard of it. I'd heard of hepatitis, but like most people even now, they don't know what the different types are. And what was most salient to me at the time was Dr. Cassidy, the liver specialist, telling me, you have to quit drinking. I mean, that was, thinking back on this last night and really thinking about what we would talk about today, that was probably more salient than anything, even though I was really afraid that, like, because I think then my dad, you know, within that week said something to me about, you know, this could kill you and stuff like that. And so there was this fear, but being 19, it was, of course, about the immediate, you know, and in the immediate, I couldn't go drink with my friends. That was really problematic for me. And so, I mean, I think at that point, it was more about the lifestyle change I was supposed to be making. That was probably the most salient and difficult thing for me. I mean, at that time, there really wasn't much treatment available. So that wasn't even really discussed or on the table. So it was just kind of like, you need to quit drinking. And that was about where we were in that first part.
I'd be asking you to go back for a bit, and you may say, I don't remember. But knowing that drinking, this was something you did with your friends, was there anything else about stopping drinking that you just didn't want to do beyond the friends?
I mean, I love to drink. I mean, it was a big part of my identity. I was a big partier. I mean, so it was like, who am I without drinking? So I guess that's, mm-hmm. you know, that was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing how to be social without it. Yeah, I mean, it was a big part of my social world.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Southern Louisiana, which is a heavy, heavy drinking culture. It's very normative to drink. So the idea that I wasn't supposed to drink was huge. It was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wasn't able to stop drinking. I drank much less frequently, but I still did drink some and then felt awful after.
When you talked about your dad being a pathologist and you could see the urgency in his face and mm-hmm. the fear around these elevated enzymes, do you remember anything on his face after those few days when you found out that it was Hep C? Do you remember feeling any of the similar urgency or fear from him?
Yes. I think there was a little bit of disgust in there, too, from him. Judgment, disappointment, concern, too, but definitely a sense of disapproval, for sure. It was definitely a sense of, like, you screwed up.
Hmm. Did he ever tell you that? Did he ever say that to you?
No, but it was quite obvious.
Mm-hmm.
He said other things that I think would... It was very much the rhetoric that, of course, I later learned about of, like, blaming the victim,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm.
My mom was much more compassionate and terrified for me. So there was that other side of it.
And so do you remember feeling, I mean, I would imagine you'd have some, like, worry and being like, what is this thing? But do you remember having that same fear or terrified feelings?
That came later. Mm. That came later for me. I don't think, at least in the first, I don't know, 6 months, year. I mean, I think it was always in the back of my mind, and either I denied it or I was just too young.
19.
To really, like, truly comprehend the implications. And also, I mean, this was, well, I think the internet existed then, but I certainly didn't know about it. You know, I mean, it wasn't in the age where we go Google stuff. So there just wasn't the sense of imminence to it or salience for me. So in some ways, I think that insulated me from worrying as much as I might have in today's
mm-hmm.
age.
Mm-hmm.
So.
In terms of prevention, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but mm-hmm. looking at it mm-hmm. from a 19-year-old perspective,
sure.
But also knowing you today is who I know, you're in front of 19-year-olds
mm-hmm.
as a profession,
mm-hmm.
Doing... teaching people as a
mm-hmm.
professor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess I look at, you're speaking to the very age group of when you were diagnosed
mm-hmm.
and that brain
mm-hmm.
and knowing in development where they are and where they're not.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, and not even so much what might you say to them, but in terms of prevention,
mm-hmm.
what, like, could you have, could have this have been prevented for you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you see, you know, this was 20 or so years ago, what do you see that might be different now that your people that you're teaching, these youth, these young people, aren't necessarily having to experience that you may have had to
mm-hmm.
to experience?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple components I could answer in that. I mean, one of the things, first, yes, this could have been completely prevented for me if I would have had access to harm reduction organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and so that would be part of my answer. And it actually is what I do in my classroom, is I, when it's relevant to the course topic, you know, et cetera, but talk about harm reduction. And most of my students have never heard of the concept of harm reduction.
Hmm.
I mean, that's really a new concept for them. And once they start to understand it, then it makes sense to them. And they become, you know, if it would be a policy decision they'd have to vote on or support, they're like, yes, this makes sense. I think discourse about harm reduction, both at a public and political level, are much greater now than they were 20 years ago. So I think that's a huge point of prevention, and something that, you know, I'm an active supporter of now is harm reduction organizations. Just simply spreading discourse about hepatitis and what it is and
mm-hmm.
how it's transmitted. I think we still could do a lot better as a society to disseminate that information. I think there's a lot of confusion still when you bring up hepatitis. People say, I think I'm vaccinated for that. Yeah, some of them, but you know, not this one. So I would say public education, but definitely for people who are using substances, harm reduction organizations are the key to prevention.
Mm-hmm. And within that, you know, embedded is relationships, really.
Absolutely.
And the relationships that are built and how that discourse is discoursed.
Right. Yeah.
I'm hoping you could speak a little bit to the relationships in your life, mm-hmm. in the various roles that you play, how they've been impacted by a diagnosis and mm-hmm. needing to tell certain people about it or not, and, mm-hmm. and how that impacts your daily life, especially over the past, the evolution of the past 20 years.
Sure. Yeah. So disclosure is a huge issue for anyone with chronic illness, but especially with a stigmatized illness, right? And so when I first was diagnosed, I told a lot of my friends. And then what happened in response was a lot of pity and a lot of fear from my friends. Not all were college students, but they were all young people, you know, 19, 20, 21, early 20s. And I was known as a rowdy drinker, and suddenly it was, she shouldn't be drinking, she can't drink. So then everyone, well, not everyone, some people still like to drink with me, but my really good friends, people who really cared about me, I would hide it from them. Mm-hmm. If I was drinking, they would constantly be checking on me, which was sweet, but it annoyed me at the time. One of the things with disclosure that I had to grapple with was disclosing to sexual partners. And that is one thing I sought out information about from the liver specialist. You know, can I transmit this to people? And he pretty much assured me that it was very unlikely. So I didn't disclose that to most of my sexual partners because I was pretty confident that there was no risk. So I told friends pretty easily. And if it was someone I was having like a relationship with, I would tell them. If it was just like a one night stand, that really wasn't relevant, mm-hmm. especially if we were having safe sex. Mm-hmm. So the issues where disclosure has been most fraught for me is in healthcare settings, I would say, and which has remained a constant, really. I mean, revealing that in healthcare has, I've had numerous unpleasant interactions in doctor's offices, and this was back in the 90s as well as even to like the last couple years. Mm. So that's definitely been an issue. The other sort of issue with disclosure that I would think about would, once I became a researcher who studied hepatitis, again, I'm jumping to early 2000s, through the couple, I did my dissertation about people's experiences living with hepatitis C. And I didn't really talk about my own status because I was afraid, which I find incredibly fascinating that, I'm sitting here studying people with a stigmatizing illness because I have it and I'm afraid to. I mean, it wasn't necessarily in the interview settings. That's not really a, you know, that's debatable whether that's appropriate to reveal that to my respondents. But even later when I would be talking about my research, either at academic conferences or talking about my research with students, I had undergrads transcribing the interviews. Mm. I didn't tell them I had it. And then I actually had one do a transcription of an interview where I did tell the person, and she emailed me and was like, you said some stuff in the interview that you hadn't really told us. So then I asked her to keep it private. And
is that, were you worried when she, I mean, did you know that before she started transcribing that it was like, oh, this is a story that I came out and.
I forgot that mm-hmm. I said that in that particular interview. I wouldn't mm-hmm. have assigned her that interview mm-hmm. if I had remembered mm-hmm. that.
Do you think you would have done it yourself?
Totally. Okay. Yeah, I would not have. And actually, in saying this, I forgot. I did tell them I had it. I didn't tell them how I got it, I think is what I did. Mm-hmm. They did know I had it, but I was just very vague mm-hmm. about how I got it. Mm-hmm. And I guess in that particular interview, I was explicit mm-hmm. with my respondent. And so I didn't really worry about it. I was kind of friendly with the students, so it wasn't a big deal. But even once I got my first you know, academic position after graduating, and I would talk about my research, I just kept it very academic. I didn't talk about my own personal relationship to the research, to hepatitis, except to close friends in academia. It's only after two things, and I'm jumping around, but once I got tenure, I felt I had impunity to reveal that I had it. I felt I had some insulation from judgment from faculty colleagues. So that was something that really empowered me in some ways to just be very like, whatever, I have this. Also, I got tenure, I think, 2 years ago, 1 or 2 years ago. I can't remember. Maybe two. And then last year, I took Harvoni, the you know, great new hyper-expensive drug that's all over the news all the time. And I mean, I posted a picture of it. I think you saw. Right. I posted a picture of the pill on Facebook and was like, this is going to cure me of this disease I've had for 20 years. And I mean, I have like 1,000 Facebook friends, many of whom are faculty colleagues, many are former students. And at that point, it was really freeing. Mm-hmm. But that kind of meshes with the academic literature about once you're cured of something stigmatized, it's easier to be like, oh, yeah, I had this thing, but I don't now. So yeah. It's okay for me to tell you.
Yeah.
So those... I mean, and telling you all this because I think it's important to think about, even for someone who's studying it, like, I was still terrified that people were going to judge me, you know?
Yeah.
And even now, I'd say that there's still there's still a slight fear. And even though I speak very publicly about it, you know,
it's a risk.
Yeah, it is a risk. Yeah.
I want to just sort of in the vein of relationships, there was something you were talking about earlier, and I'm kind of talking to your 19-year-old Alicia right now, where your friends had, many had this sort of pity and worry, mm-hmm. And it wasn't helpful for you. It was annoying. Mm-hmm. What would have been helpful in terms of their response? Hindsight's 20/20, but what do you think you needed then?
So I actually think their response was appropriate. I think I found it annoying because I was struggling so hard with quitting drinking. So it was more, I saw them as like a nanny, you know what I mean? Like trying to, I think if alcohol hadn't been this issue, I think the response was very appropriate. Caring, empathetic, checking in with me, seeing if I needed anything. I mean, the pity, I think it was scary for them, you know, to have this friend who was diagnosed with this weird chronic thing that no one really knew what it was. And I think they were probably scared.
I guess I ask because drinking is a very normal behavior in our culture.
Right.
And many people experiment and use substances. And
right.
a smaller, but still, you know, it's a substantive part of the population go on to develop, you know, challenges with substances.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm thinking in terms of this vein of prevention, mm-hmm. You know, there... understandable worry and concern is partly what caused you to become secretive.
Right.
And that secretive in itself, luckily, you know, things changed for you and, you know, you were able to eventually get cured and whatnot down the line. But that secretive piece could be really dangerous and spiral someone even further.
Totally.
I'm just sort of looking through the lens of reaching out to someone who is in the midst of getting a pretty devastating diagnosis of a disease on top of having challenges with, you know, maybe wanting to not feel emotions, so using substances
to do that. Right, right.
And I'm worried about you. I'm going to reach out, which is going to cause you to retreat a bit.
Right.
You know, I'm just thinking about that 19-year-old and what maybe her worried friends, which were absolutely appropriate mm-hmm. worry, mm-hmm. what they could have done to be a bit more helpful. And hindsight's 20/20, they were doing the best
right,
that they could.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I don't know.
Hard
I don't
question.
Know. Yeah, it is a hard question. I think if... my drinking wouldn't have been an issue, it would be different. Of course, I wouldn't have ended up with hepatitis C if substances hadn't been a part of my life. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure what they could have. I mean, I would have people come and grab drinks out of my hand, you know, if mm-hmm. they saw me at the bar drinking or mm-hmm. whatever. And or, you know, they'd be getting beers for people and like, well, Alicia can't have one. I don't know. Maybe they could have engaged in more non-alcohol related socialization. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's asking a lot.
Think outside.
Yeah. I mean, that's asking a lot of them, you know. But I mean, that's what I felt left out.
Yeah.
I felt left out. That was basically, you know, and I felt like a child that they're like, well, she can't have a beer. She can't have that wine or, you know, and it was like, well, yeah, I can. I can just have a little bit.
And as it relates to your parents, were your parents married at the time?
No.
No. Okay. Was there any way, I mean, you were 19, which is still a kid, but kind of this adult, that diagnosed dad's this doctor, has connections to, you know, Bill Cassidy, all these different things, that you felt like this child in the relationship with your parents and become a bit more?
I was a very independent teenager and had kind of been out of that child role, if you will, for quite a few years at that point.
And spread your wings and way far.
Quite defiantly. Yeah. So I don't think I really had that sense of them. I mean, they were very compassionate and concerned, but I had put them through a lot for many years. So I mean, and I just lied to them. I told them that I quit drinking, you know, and I did reduce my drinking a lot. So if you weren't around me every day, I looked better. So I think they believed me. Mm-hmm. They probably wanted to believe me too, you know? And so, yeah.
Again, sort of on this trend of relationships, you know, you talk about stigma and, the things that stigma naturally brings around, which, you know, shame and all these pieces that would prevent someone maybe from going to their provider.
Totally.
Can you tell me a little bit about things that you have experienced that sort of shocked you? I mean, we're clearly stigmatizing, but kind of shocked you a bit, be it healthcare, be it, I mean, people can only hear you right now, not see you, but, you know, you're got tattoos all over and, you know, you're a hip chick, you know? So, like, I'm just real curious about what you've experienced that way.
That's a good question. I think, I mean, I'm trying to think of one of the first, like, formative stigmatizing experiences. I was really ashamed even when talking with Dr. Cassidy that first day, you know, also because he was a colleague of my father. So I knew my father felt really embarrassed that this was his daughter who was being diagnosed with this disease that's associated with drug use. And so I felt a lot of shame then because I could sense my father's shame. And that was really hard.
Yeah.
To, you know, feel that he was embarrassed. You know, he was embarrassed about his daughter. And so that was really hard. I never really got that feeling from my mother, per se. But, of course, this wasn't affecting her in her professional life, right? You know what I mean? So, I mean, this was into my dad's work world. So that was tough. I think, I mean, I have a couple of you know, these moments that I can think about in terms of healthcare providers. Hilariously, my mom was with me at this one doctor's office, and this was 2003. So I'd already started formulating my dissertation, and I'm jumping around, but my dissertation came about because of my experiences with stigmatization and my experiences with this disease, right? So I already had this tentative title that it was going to be called. So how did you get that? And I had just been talking to my mom about it. I was down in Baton Rouge. She was at the doctor's office with me. It was not related to hepatitis. But of course, it's on my medical records when I come in, and the physician was, you know, kind of chit-chatting with me, looks me up and down. So how'd you get that? And I mean, I almost started cracking up. My mom and I just looked at each other. I'm like, you know, see? And, you know, over the years when I would be asked it, I would get more and more flippant because of my, like, anger about, like, that is not clinically relevant to why I'm seeing you.
Do you have a favorite reply?
Sometimes it would just be like, well, there's a variety of ways to get it. And just really, like, we're not talking about this, you know. And actually with this nurse who is the gastroenterologist who ended up treating me last year, her nurse, who was such a sweetheart, but the first day asked me, well, do you know how you got this? And I looked at her and I said, so why is that clinically relevant?
What was her reply to that?
She said, well, it's important to know if someone who got it through IV drug use is still using, and if they need help with, you know, accessing methadone or Suboxone, or which, okay, there's a little bit of veracity to that, but we then had like a 10-minute conversation, and I, you know, let her know that like, this is really off-putting to patients, because to patients, it feels like you're immediately trying to establish, so is this person a junkie? Which in many ways they are. That is what they're trying to establish, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think with some providers, they'd look at my tattoos and sometimes assume that. And sometimes I would let them assume that. Mm-hmm. That like, oh, it could have been one of my tattoos. Who knows? You know, just really vague. So I'd change how I'd answer depending on my mood and what I thought of the provider.
Probably real different from what your response was at 19 or 20, huh?
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, this was me as a 30-something-year-old woman who, yes, had been studying this and just much more confident and sassy. Mm-hmm. You know? So the other thing that I could mention about that, I had to have a surgery a couple years ago, boring hernia surgery, met with a surgeon. You know, of course, it was in my medical records that I had hepatitis. And so I was asking him about recovery and like, well, how long will it be? You know, I have little kids, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, well, you know, it depends on what drugs you're using. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, you know, if you're currently using illegal substances, that's going to affect your recovery.
Wow.
Yeah. And this was literally like maybe 2012, 2013, like 6 years after getting my PhD, told this guy, you know, so I sent him a letter. He was on the board of directors at the hospital where I live. Mm. And I sent him this really long letter on university letterhead. Mm. Of course, I got no response. But, you know, just this, I guess my point is that it doesn't matter who I am now, that I've done research on this, that I've published about it. All I was to him was a potential drug user, mm-hmm, and that it was going to screw up his numbers probably if something happened to me post-op. Mm. I mean, that way, obviously, I didn't choose him. So those are some of the worst with healthcare providers. One instance that is the most memorable probably for me, and this was maybe, I don't know, early 2000s, maybe 2001, 2002, I'm not sure. As you noted, I'm very heavily tattooed, and I start getting tattoos prior to getting diagnosed with hepatitis, like very early 90s. And after diagnosis, I always told tattooists, by the way, I have hep C. No big deal. I didn't really mind disclosing to these folks. And 99% of the time, and I've been tattooed by a lot of different people, they're like, oh, yeah, no big deal, whatever. We treat everyone as if they've got something, you know. I went to this one shop that I'd been tattooed at before, been tattooed at numerous times, in fact, but I was going to go to a different tattooist there. And I get there to talk about, I don't remember if we had an appointment or we were just talking about what we might do. I don't remember the details, but another guy who worked there had already told him, oh yeah, Alicia, she has hepatitis. So he kind of told me, yeah, well, I heard you had hepatitis. So-and-so told me. I was like, yeah, is that a problem? You know, and I said, I would have told you if you would have given me the chance to, you know, it wasn't like I would have hid that from you. So already it was starting off on this really weird dynamic that I've never had in that context. And he said, well, you know, I'd tattoo you, but I'd need to wear like a mask and protective eye gear. And I have never felt dirtier in my entire life. I mean, that was huge for me. I mean, that was huge because this was sort of a, if you want to call it a subculture, if you will, that I was very much a part of, that I'd been a part of for over a decade, like the tattoo world. It had status, if you will, in that world because I have so many tattoos. I'm seen as an insider. I know the business. I know the art. And for a tattooist to say that to me, like I was someone with like Ebola that you had to wear this like space suit to tattoo me. I don't even remember exactly what I said to him. I think I just said, well, then just don't worry about it or something along those lines. And I don't think I expressed outrage. I think I was so shocked by it. also it felt like it was coming from one of my people. Mm. You know what I mean? Versus like some, you know, stuffy doctor or something, but someone who I just thought would be more sympathetic.
So with that, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I got distracted.
Well, I mean, I could say that that's what really spawned my dissertation.
Thank you. I was going to say, what was that a catalyst
for?
Yeah, I mean, that was exactly where I was going.
That was totally the catalyst for me deciding that I was going to, I'm a sociologist. I don't think I mentioned that, that I was going to study. So there's this whole area called chronic illness experience in sociology. And there was not, and there still isn't a ton of literature about chronic illness experience with hepatitis. So I decided that's what my research was going to be. And I spent the next number of years doing qualitative interviews with 53 people with hepatitis C, some who had been treated, and this was, again, the old regimen, interferon and ribavirin, and some who hadn't been treated. And I had never been treated at that point. And that became more relevant later. But that became part of my academic and professional life. Was someone who studies hepatitis and who is, you know, a scholar about hepatitis, which is then what led into becoming an advocate and an activist and how I ended up meeting you.
That's right.
So when I moved out to the West Coast, my first academic position after graduation, I don't even know how it happened. It was very serendipitous, but I got kind of hooked up with some people in hepatitis world out there, got invited to speak at some kind of harm reduction things, and became sort of involved in hepatitis advocacy at a regional. And then later, when Michael Nimberg asked me to be on the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable Steering Committee, which is how I met you.
That's where we served there together.
You know, now I'm involved at a national level. I've gone to Congress and you know, talked about having hepatitis publicly. So it's been quite the journey.
So, Alicia, you know, knowing you're a patient, you're a researcher, you're cured, you're an activist, you're all these things. You know, I think about, especially through the lens of advocacy and especially through the lens of relationship, you being a mom with two young kids and that while you're not 19 today, there is a group of 19-year-olds right now who are getting hepatitis C as well. And I'm wondering, you know, with that advocacy hat, with that activism hat, with this group of youth that you have, young people that you have access to, how does being a mom and does being a mom sort of come into how you choose to be an advocate and how you choose to be, quote, out as a cured person?
I mean, I think I've kind of dedicated my career, my professional career, to studying people who are marginalized in some way. I mean, you know, that's what interests me. Like, freaks interest me. People who are disenfranchised and marginalized, those are my people. Even though I have a ton of class privilege. But so I guess what, you know, I mean, this has been hardest with my kids, you know, in terms of deciding to have children, even though the perinatal transmission rate is pretty low. Being terrified that my kids were going to get hepatitis.
It's terrifying giving birth in general, I would imagine. And then being hepatitis C and giving birth is this whole other.
Yeah. And you can't test them until they're 18 months old. So I had to wait, you know, to find out. And I mean, that was really scary and felt, I think there's sort of the rhetoric that it's irresponsible of people with HIV or people with hepatitis C to have children because you could pass it on to them. So there's sort of the idea that, like, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad mother, I'm selfish. So how would I talk about that to 19-year-olds? I think it actually gives me a little bit of a maternal response to those 19-year-olds. And, you know, wanting to protect them and wanting them to not have to go through this. Wanting them to know that they're going to be okay. Deep compassion, I would say, for 19-year-olds and wishing and hoping that they don't have to have this for 20 years. And, you know, I think the thing with treatment, you know, for a long time until the last couple of years, we just had this interferon and ribavirin. Well, ribavirin came around later. And for someone with my genotype, it was a 50-50 response rate. And you would have to do it for 48 weeks and probably get super sick. And my husband and I, you know, we talked about it. And, you know, I didn't have my first child until I was 30, typical academic. And, you know, we wanted more children. And so it was like, and my liver, I was always in pretty good shape. You know, I quit drinking quite early. And so my liver was pretty healthy. But having to just push off treatment and know that eventually there was this specter of like, eventually I'm going to have to do this awful thing and it might not even work. And that was always, I think, scary for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then these amazing new drugs came out. And I took an 8-week course of Harvoni. No side effects. Didn't have to argue with my insurance company, which I feel very privileged to have had that experience. And I'm cured. I mean, it's still surreal to me.
Yeah.
It's still surreal.
And I have two questions with that. One is, did your boys have any questions for you about this?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to explain to them, like, well, mommy had this sickness, and I have to take this medicine, and this is really exciting.
Mm.
And I'm sure as they get older, I'll talk to them about it, and I'll have no problem with that. I mean, with sharing with them. I mean, I'm pretty proud of being an activist, you know what I mean? And being, even when I'm afraid to reveal all this,
yeah.
Because some people will judge me and some people do judge me, and that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
But I care more about spreading my experience that it might help other people and help other people feel like they're not alone. And if I can shout that from the rooftops, there's people who can judge me. There's people that'll judge me for whatever reason. So, and I want to share that with my boys. I want them to know that's who their mother is. You know?
Yeah. We got a lot of people who support you and, you know, hold you up when you're up there being brave. And I've seen you be brave in the Senate building, in offices, on the ground. And I thank you for that because it's not easy to come out.
You're welcome.
And keep doing it. However, of course, I can help sort of give you a spotlight to just talk. I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Well, but you did with this opportunity.
But before we do go, in just our last few minutes,
sure.
What, as an advocate sitting mm-hmm. in front of me, what now that mm-hmm. you're cured?
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
I'm going to keep doing this. You know, now my research has turned to studying women in prison.
Mm.
And I taught a class at a women's prison last semester. And, of course, hepatitis C came up casually in my class. And, you know, I real casually was like, I just got cured. And some of the women are like, wow, we wish we could get the medication. And that was really humbling for me. That
was got chills, yeah.
That was a real moment of like, I need to check my privilege, you know, for me as a sociologist, right? But it also made me really, I think my new focus, while I'm studying women who are pregnant in prison, a lot of women have hepatitis. So I think that might be my new sort of where I might be going with my focus on hepatitis is hepatitis in corrections.
Yes.
Which is desperately, desperately needed, as you well know, because as I keep saying, prison health is public health.
Ain't that the truth?
So I think that's what you'll see me heading in the next couple years.
Sweet. Well, I can help you come test or do whatever I can to
Great.
Help you do that. Thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
To Chicago.
Thank you. Thanks.